Hi, folks. Jack Spirko here. Today you are listening to an episode of TSP Rewind. Commercial-free versions of past episodes. Podcast blasts from the past. I put these up when I can't do a show due to professional commitments or rare vacations. These podcasts will appear in standard iTunes, Stitcher, and other feeds, but will be titled TSP Rewind episodes and numbered accordingly. And today, folks, we are rewinding back to May the 7th, 2019, episode 2433, Understanding Systemic versus Natural Capitalism. This might be one of the most intellectual shows that I've ever done. And I think it's a really important show because what it does is it breaks your belief that a certain system, which would be systemic capitalism, is that which makes you free in this country, because it isn't. It is the primary system to control you within this country. That doesn't mean that capitalism in itself is a bad thing. Because today's show is called Understanding Systemic versus Natural Capitalism. I find it very interesting. I did an experiment just before I left for my vacation. And, of course, I'm almost done with it now. You guys will have me back on Thursday of this week as we're kicking off on Monday today, if I've done the math right and got this in my head right. Because, boy, when you do 13 rewinds, guys, you get confused. I'm just going to be honest. Like, you cram 13 rewind shows into about 5 days of work, you get very confused about where you're at. But I think this should be a Monday show. Anyway, also, if you've been paying very close attention, you've noticed that all the shows that I've done in the rewind series came forward in history, and today's went backward from the last one. That's because I got confused and I skipped this one and did the one that I did Friday before it. So I've rectified that by resurrecting it. Anyway, I put this thing up on Facebook, and I really didn't want people building on other people's comments. I did the same thing on Twitter. I got quite a few responses on Twitter, but way more on Facebook. I said, define capitalism as you see it, right? Don't look at anybody else's comments until you put down your own definition. And I don't think people cheated, but the definitions were dramatically similar. They were explained differently, but they all got to the same point. And it was basically a system where we have a free exchange of goods and services between individuals. We call that agorism. And agorism is a type of capitalism. It's a type of natural capitalism. It is not systemic capitalism, and I'll let the, again, like I've been doing, I'll let the episodes speak for themselves today. This is a very rare episode in that I read a very long article in totality in it, and you'll hear that in just a moment. And I do that because I felt that it was necessary for framing this. But what you'll notice is, about the first half of the article, I didn't notice this myself until I listened to this episode myself after I published it. The first part of the article, you might struggle with some cognitive dissonance, and I try to prep you for it, and you'll hear that in the original intro to it. But you'll kind of like, yeah, he's right. I completely agree, but I don't like that I agree. Like, you'll feel that way for the first half of the article. About midway through the article, there'll be a shift in tone, and you might be thinking, gee, Jack sounds like he's reading something versus just saying something, but has he left the article? And I haven't. I'm still reading the article. All of a sudden, it starts to sound exactly like the things that I've been telling you for a very long time. And the lesson in that is a lot of things that we believe simply are not true because we believe them. And this is the problem that I think that most people on the right, or on, let's say, the cap side, the ANCAP side of anarchism or libertarianism, anarcho-libertarian, anarcho-capitalist, right-wing conservative, you know, everybody except the crazy people on that side of the spectrum. And, yes, the left has the same problem from the same vantage point, and you'll hear all about it today, right? You'll hear all about it today. So I'm going to leave them out because they are the vast minority of people listening to me today. My audience comes from a very liberty-centric place, so we naturally gravitate toward things that sound like what we believe. But just because you have a nation that defines itself as a capitalist nation doesn't mean that it's actually a capitalist nation. And even if it is, if you are allowing the state to use capitalism, it's no longer capitalism because it's not natural, because it's not between individuals. So what I find interesting is the whole block of people that I just mentioned, from the conservative to the anarcho-libertarian to the capitalist libertarian, the ANCAP, even many that call themselves pure agorists, like myself. If you say that the systems in the United States are designed to control people, they agree. Okay. And if you say that these systems are set up in such a way that it is almost impossible for a person to truly be free unless they break outside of those systems, they agree. Okay. Then when you say this system of capitalism in the United States is being used to control people, they lose their minds and they disagree. Well, which one is it? And you say, well, it's not real capitalism. That sounds an awful lot like it's not real communism. See, instead of it's not real, it's not natural. That's the mindset I want you to go in today. And I'm gonna let it go there because I think this episode more than speaks for itself. And I think it might be challenging, but I think that's, especially as we round out this 13-part series, challenge is something that we need in our lives. And you're going to hear today how people in power view challenge, and I'm going to submit to you that you'd be much better off challenging yourself than having someone starve you into working in a factory, which actually is the foundation of a lot of this systemic capitalism. And I guess I'll go just a little bit more on this, so you prime your mind the right way with this before I give you your step today. The entire concept put forth about agorism by Samuel Conklin, who I really recommend his books, they're short, they're easy to read, is that we do not need a system of capitalism, because capitalism is a natural state. Nor do we need a system of socialism, because socialism is a natural state. If you leave people alone, and you don't try to control them, people naturally exchange goods and services, and people naturally cooperate. When you're naturally exchanging goods and services, you're engaging in natural capitalism. When you do natural cooperative behavior, in other words, this neighborhood needs security, so we will put together some solution that we will all contribute to because we live here and we all think it's valuable, it's a type of socialism. And I know that repels the brain for many of you because, well, socialism's like what they do in the Soviet Union. No, relax. There is systemic socialism and there is natural socialism. And every time humans naturally cooperate and combine resources, you have natural social engagement, if that makes you feel better. Right? So, IST, is a prefix that means to specialize in. Specialize in socializing. Socialist actually is someone who specializes in socializing. That's what the word actually means. Until you turn it into socialism overriding a nation. Or a state of some form. So, I know that's challenging. Wait till you hear the article. It's really going to be challenging. But challenge is what causes us to grow. Remember the story of the lobster from the rabbi. If humans were like lobsters, we would start to feel discomfort. We would go to a doctor, and the doctor would give us a medication, and the discomfort would go away, and we would stop growing, and we would never shed our shell. That's what lobsters would do if they were like humans. And then they would never grow. You'd have a bunch of little bitty lobsters the size of crayfish. But instead, the lobster goes through the discomfort, becomes vulnerable, the shell rehardens, and you have a larger, more large lobster. It grows. So, get ready for some discomfort. Now, if that wasn't enough, today we get to step 11 in your 11-part series, and this might be the most difficult step of all. And the reason this step is difficult is you can't do anything material to aid it along. It's 100% internal. And that seems like, well, that would be easy. Jack doesn't have an assignment that he can grade and give me an A or a B or a C or a D. By the way, that doesn't work this way here. These steps I'm giving you this week, this is like military training. If you were actually tested on them, it's a go, no go. You either did it or you didn't. There's no A or B or C. It's go, no go. Did you get a go on your last 10? Will you get a go today? This one's going to be hard. This has been, it's been amazing to me that we live in a place that we describe as a culture of entitlement, and yet people struggle to do this, which proves that we actually don't have an entitlement culture. We have a very sick society that has become convinced somebody took something from them, so they should be given it back. That's actually not a sense of entitlement. A sense of entitlement is I should sit here and things should just show up. It's actually very hard to convince people of that. When I give you your step today, you're going to understand how hard it actually is, because you're going to be like, I can't really accept that, many of you anyway, especially if you've never heard me talk about it before. But the way you get a sociopathic society, when true sociopathy is actually very rare, is you convince an entire group of people, let's say the college students of today and the recently graduated and the soon to go in, you convince them through the educational system that's actually an indoctrination, that somebody took that which belonged to them away from them, and those people should give it back. So they don't feel entitled, they feel incensed. And you'll hear today that there's actually a case for it, just of course the solution that you give them isn't one that actually works, because then you would not be able to keep using that system to control them. You don't actually want to solve the problem. Well, that's silly. You solve the problem, you lose your system of control, which you'll hear a lot about today. But isn't it interesting that when I tell you this step, many of you will immediately bristle. This step, accept the fact that you deserve exactly what you want. There's another piece to it. Some of you have heard it before, so you know it's coming. But I'll say it one more time. And if this bothers you, I want you to think about everything I've said up till now. I'm going to say it again. Accept. I want you, whatever your name is, insert name here. Insert name here. Accept the fact that you deserve exactly what you want. Do you have a hard time with that? Well, I'm not entitled. Most people have a hard time with this. 15-year-old kid has a hard time with it. Indoctrinated college student with a mountain of debt that wants Bernie Sanders to solve the problem, when you put it down to a personal level like that and you tell them you deserve exactly what they want, that so-called entitled child says, well, wait a minute, everybody does. Well, here's the second part. Accept the fact that you deserve exactly what you want and that you simply have not done the work yet. Now the full picture. You deserve exactly what you want in life. You deserve it. You just have to work for it. Now, that can be twisted, as you'll hear in today's episode, as a system of control, because the entire predication of the system of control is to take a carrot of what a person wants and put it in front of them like the donkey, and the donkey keeps going, but the carrot gets no closer. Only by working at the individual level for what you want in your life, and by following the types of steps that I've given you this week, like actually figuring out what that is in the first place, and then actually challenging yourself to figure out how to get it, only then can you actually break free of the systems of control. It's the only way. Because as long as you're working 100% within the system, even when you work in the system, you have to be aware of it. Like, okay, all this shit over here is my little anarcho-paradise that I'm creating for myself. And because I want more stuff in there, and because I can procure things outside of it, now I'm working in the system. And I need to understand very, very clearly, I'm playing with a dangerous thing. It's like being a snake keeper and you've taken the rattlesnake out of the cage. I used to work with hot reptiles, as they're called. I don't anymore, but I used to. I learned how to do this as a kid. And one of the things I learned to be able to do this properly was there's actually, unless you're doing something like milking a snake, and even that can be done without effort, actually touching the animal in many ways. There's a point where you have to, but if you never touch the animal, if you never actually touch the snake, there's no reason for you to ever get bit. You can work with literally dozens of rattlesnakes and cobras, etc., a day. And there are rules to follow. And if you follow those rules, it's not that you can't get bit. It's the instances of handlers being bit following those rules is extensively low. You're probably more likely to get in a car wreck and die than to end up in the hospital from being bit by a venomous reptile if you follow those rules. And when you go into the systems of control of society to procure what you want for what you're building outside of those systems, and whenever you're at that interactive edge between your systems and their systems, it's okay. But you have to be aware. You have to be aware that's what you're doing. And if you're not, you're going to get bit. And in this case, imagine that the snake doesn't actually kill you with its venom or make your arm necrotic so you need an amputation. Think about the cartoon version of Jungle Book where the snake is like doing something snakes don't really do. It's like hypnotizing the kid. Oh, and it's hypnotizing him. Imagine that the venom of this metaphorical snake that bites you, it hypnotizes you and puts you back to sleep and pulls you deeper back into the system. Okay. The way you get past that is you work the steps that we've been talking about this week, or this last 2 weeks, and you accept the fact that you deserve what you want. See, what the entire system of control is predicated upon is you actually not believing you deserve it, so that you'll keep working harder and harder and harder and harder to have it, and yet not, but you won't quit because you believe that if I work hard enough, I'll overcome the fact that I don't really deserve it. It's a crazy psychology, but it's actually incredibly easy to understand. Instead of actually carving out the path, here, I want this, I'm going to make this path, and gee, now I have it, right? Instead of doing that, if I just keep working the system the way it's designed to be worked, eventually I will have these things. And see, even the people that are titans of the system, they didn't work the system. They worked outside of it, and they created an apparatus in the system. Jeff Bezos didn't get where he is by working really hard for a company. Okay? Bill Gates didn't get where he is by, and I'm not admiring these men, by the way. I'm just pointing something out. They didn't go to work inside a company and work really hard and move up the corporate ladder. And anybody that's done that, I did it. Anybody that's done that, you know what happens. You get promoted, and then you get promoted again, and now you're at a level that, you know, let's say 3 years ago, you were like, man, if I ever get there, I've got it made. And you're like, this sucks. Honest to God, you're like, this sucks. In fact, in many instances, the higher you rise inside a corporate system, the more miserable you become. The more likely you are to put a gun in your mouth someday and blow your brains out. You look at the statistics, it's true. And you go, I don't understand. This guy has lots of money. Why is he miserable? Because he's not fulfilling his life purpose. And because he doesn't, believe it or not, actually have what he wants. He doesn't have what he deserves. He's actually done more work, but he's done the wrong work. Because he doesn't really believe that he deserves what he really wants. Because most people do not want lifestyles of the rich and famous. Like I've said before, most people, if I started giving you money, here's $1 million. And as soon as you realized, like, I was serious, you'd be like, holy shit, my life has changed forever. Here's $5 million. Wow. Here's $10 million. And there's a point where you're going to start to feel a little bit afraid. And there's a point at which you're going to say, you know what? Find somebody else. I'll take this much. I'm done. I don't need any more. Because you're not a psychopath. Because you're not a sociopath. Because you realize that there's a certain amount of money that creates a certain amount of power that you don't want. You don't want that much power because you're not a psychopath. So why do you constantly grind away at a system that only really promises more power? Because there's lots of ways to make more money. There's tremendous ways to make, unbelievable ways to have more money. But we tend to work more for a title than we do for a raise. The raise comes with the title. And the raise is already spent before we get it. It will buy a larger car payment, not a nicer car. That's the world that we live in today. And it does go back to this thing. And this is why it's the hard step. Here's the reason this step's so hard. No one can do it for you. I can't accept that you deserve what you want for you any more than I can go watch the sunrise for you. The sun will rise. I will go watch it. I will appreciate it. I will see its true beauty. You can stand right next to me and refuse to do so. You may even look at it. But if you don't really see it, it didn't really matter for you. If you didn't notice how that one cloud, as the red hit it, looked like from a song, an angel holding out a bloody sword, then I can't do it for you. I can point at it, but only you can see it. And if you don't show up on the beach that morning, there's no way you can see it. The acceptance is showing up and being open to what that sunrise looks like. And the reason it's difficult is no one can even make you do it. There's so many things in the world that's good for a person that can actually be forced upon them if necessary. If you're a drug addict, I can take your drugs away and I can put you in a place where you can't get drugs and I can keep you there. And honest to God, for most people, in about 30 days as we detox their system, we'll be able to get them into a state where they're going to be willing to admit they had a problem. And if we can help them from that point forward, we can break the addiction. We can force a person to stop using drugs. You cannot force a person to accept that they deserve what they want. It is the most difficult step of the 13 I'm giving you. But I want you to do it. And it's the only way that you will ever, ever attain that which you truly want. Accept it, define it, and do the work to acquire it. And then you will believe that it is right that you have it. And then maybe you'll value it enough and see yourself worthy enough of building enough systems of sustainability and resiliency around it so that you don't lose it. With that, let's go ahead and rewind back May 7th, 2019, episode 2433, Understanding Systemic versus Natural Capitalism. Again, when I put this together, I had to really think about the title of today's show, and it was spawned by a very anti-capitalist article at a blog called The Exiled. And it is by a guy named Yasha Levine, who's Soviet-born. And I'm going to tell you that my instinct is, because I can't actually find any declaration, that this dude's an anarchist. There's like one line in this article I'm about to read that's quite long that will kind of tip to that side. I also think he comes more from a leftist vantage point, where I am more of a capitalist anarchist, right? I think we actually agree probably more than we disagree. I just want to kind of preface that. Now, I've looked at some of his social media and stuff, and he's a lot like me in a way, because he beats up on the Republicans and the Democrats equally well. But this article and some of the things I'm going to say today might push you in the wrong direction. So what I'm going to ask you to do is something we have a hard time doing in America today. I want you to take your political ideology, whatever it is, even if it's anarchism like me, and I want you to put it in a little bowl, and I want you to set it on the shelf. It's not going to go anywhere. It doesn't have an expiration date. It's not going to go sour like milk if it's left out. I want you to just put it there for the duration of this podcast and listen with an open mind, because you're not going to hear me change who I am today and who you expect me to be. But I am going to say some things, and I don't even think the things I'm going to say or that are in this article are going to be things that you disagree with, but it will use certain terminology and words that you come to think certain things about, both positive, and then we'll talk negative about those, or words that you would think about more of a negative word, and we'll talk positively about those, and therefore it will cause some level of cognitive dissonance. None of us are immune to cognitive dissonance. There's times when I'm reading stuff or I'm listening to someone and say something I actually agree with, but there's a terminology in there and it has that kind of trigger point, like, hey, wait, please, please don't do that today. Because what I'm going to talk about today will explain to you why people actually believe in socialism as an economic system. Because when they say capitalism doesn't work, they don't mean what you mean. And you don't mean what they mean. And you are trying to discuss an ideology, a concept, where it means different things to both of you, and therefore you cannot have a decent conversation. It's impossible. So here's this article. Again, this is from Yasha Levine. It's on The Exiled. And it's called Recovered Economic History. Everyone but an idiot knows that the lower classes must be kept poor or they will never be industrious. And this is long, and I generally don't read long articles. I think this article is necessary for the show today, so I'll read it in full to you. Our popular economic wisdom says that capitalism equals freedom and free societies, right? Well, if you ever suspected that logic is full of shit, then I recommend checking out a book called The Invention of Capitalism, written by an economic historian named Michael Perlman, who has been exiled to Chico State, a redneck college in rural California, for his lack of free market friendliness. And Perlman has been putting his time in exile to damn good use, digging deep into the words and correspondence of Adam Smith and his contemporaries to write a history of the creation of capitalism that goes beyond superficial The Wealth of Nations fairy tale and straight to the source, allowing you to read the early capitalists, economists, philosophers, clergymen, and statesmen in their own words, and it ain't pretty. One thing that the historical record makes obviously clear is that Adam Smith and his laissez-faire buddies, Here's where you know this guy's probably an anarchist writing this article. His closet, one thing that the historical record makes obviously clear is that Adam Smith and his laissez-faire buddies were a bunch of closet statists who needed brutal government policies to whip the English peasantry into a good capitalistic workforce, willing to accept wage slavery. Francis Hutcheson, for whom Adam Smith learned all about the virtue of natural liberty, wrote, quote, "If it is the one great design of civil laws to strengthen by political sanctions the several laws of nature, the populace needs to be taught and engaged by laws into the best methods of managing their own affairs and exercising mechanical art," end quote. Yet, despite what you may have learned, the transition to a capitalist society did not happen naturally or smoothly. See, English peasants didn't want to give up their rural communal lifestyles, leave their land and go to work for below subsistence wages in shitty, dangerous factories being set up by a new rich class of land-owning capitalists, and for good reason, too. Using Adam Smith's own estimates of factory wages being paid at the time, in Scotland, a factory peasant would have to toil for more than 3 days to buy a pair of commercially produced shoes, or they could make their own traditional brogues using their own leather in a matter of hours, and spend the rest of the time getting wasted on ale. It's not really much of a choice, is it? But in order for capitalism to work, capitalists needed a pool of cheap surplus labor. So what to do? Call in the National Guard. Faced with a peasantry that didn't feel like playing the role of slave, philosophers, economists, politicians, moralists, and leading business figures began advocating for government action. Over time, they enacted a series of laws and measures designed to push peasants out of the old and into the new by destroying their traditional means of self-support. Quote, "The brutal acts associated with the process of stripping the majority of people of the means of producing for themselves might seem far removed from the laissez-faire reputation of classical political economy," end quote, writes Perlman. Quote, "In reality, the disposition of the majority of small-scale producers and the construction of laissez-faire are closely connected, so much so that Marx, or at least his translators, labeled this expropriation of the masses as primitive accumulation," end quote. Perlman outlines that many different policies through which peasants were forced off the land, from the enactment of so-called game laws that prohibited peasants from hunting, to the destruction of the peasant productivity by fencing the commons into smaller lots. But by far the most interesting part of the book are where you get to read Adam Smith's proto-capitalist colleagues complaining and whining about how peasants are too independent and comfortable to be properly exploited, and trying to figure out how to force them to accept life of wage slavery. This pamphlet from the time captures the general attitude towards successful, self-sufficient peasant farmers. The possession of a cow or two with a hog and a few geese naturally exalts the peasant, and sauntering after his cattle, he acquires a habit of indolence. Quarter, half, and occasionally whole days are imperceptibly lost. Day labor becomes disgusting. And at length, the sale of half-fed calf or hog furnishes the means of adding intemperance to idleness. While another pamphleteer wrote, "Nor can I conceive of a greater course upon the body of people than to be thrown upon a spot of land where the productions for subsistence and food were, in great measure, spontaneous, and the climate required or admitted little care for remnant or covering." John Bellars, a Quaker philanthropist and economic thinker, saw independent peasants as a hindrance to his plan of forcing poor people into prison factories, where they would live, work, and produce a profit of 45% for aristocratic owners. Quote, "Our forests and great commons make the poor that are upon them too much like the Indians, being a hindrance to industry, and are nurseries of idleness and insolence." Daniel Defoe, a novelist and trader, noted that in the Scottish Highlands, people were extremely well furnished with provisions, venison exceedingly plentiful, and at all seasons, young or old, which they kill with their guns wherever they find it. To Thomas Pennant, a botanist, the self-sufficiency was ruining a perfectly good peasant population. Quote, "The manners of the native Highlanders may be expressed in these words, indolent to a high degree unless roused to war or anything animating amusement. If having a full belly and productive land was the problem, then the solution to whipping these lazy bums into shape was obvious. Kick them off the land and let them starve. Arthur Young, a popular writer and economic thinker respected by John Stuart Mill, wrote in 1771, "Everyone but an idiot knows that the lower classes must be kept poor or they will never be industrious," end quote. Sir William Temple, a politician and Jonathan Swift's boss, agreed and suggested that food be taxed as much as possible to prevent the working class from a life of sloth and debauchery. Temple also advocated for putting four-year-old kids to work in factories, writing, "For by these means we hope that the rising generation will be so habituated to constant employment that it would be at length prove agreeable and entertaining to them." Some thought that four was already too old. According to Perlman, John Locke, often seen as a philosopher of liberty, called for the commencement of work at the ripe age of three. Child labor also excited Defoe, who was joyed at this prospect that, quote, "children after 4 or 5 years of age could every one earn their own bread," end quote. But that's getting off topic. Even David Hume, the great humanist, hailed poverty and hunger as positive experiences for lower class, and even blamed the poverty of France on its good weather and fertile soil. Quote, "'Tis always observed in years of scarcity, if it be not extreme, that the poor labor more and really live better," end quote. Reverend Joseph Townsend believed restricting food was the way to go. "Direct legal constraint to labor is attended with too much trouble, violence, and noise, whereas hunger is not only a peaceable, silent, and unremitting pressure, but is the most natural motive to industry. It calls forth the most powerful exertions. Hunger will tame the fiercest animals. It will teach decency and civility, obedience and subjugation to the most brutish, the most obstinate, and the most perverse." Patrick Colquhoun, a merchant who set up England's first private preventative police force to prevent dock workers from supplementing their meager wages with stolen goods, provided what may be the most lucid explanation of how hunger and poverty correlate to productivity and wealth creation. Poverty is that state and condition in society where the individual has no surplus labor in store, or, in other words, no property or means of subsistence, but what is derived from the constant exercise of industry in various occupations of life. Poverty is therefore a most necessary and indispensable ingredient in society, without which nations and communities could not exist in a state of civilization. It is the lot of man. It is the source of wealth, since without poverty there could be no labor, there could be no riches, no refinement, no comfort, and no benefit to those who may be possessed of wealth. Colquhoun's summary is so on the money it has to be repeated, because what was true for English peasants is still just as true to us. Poverty is therefore a most necessary and indispensable ingredient in society. It is the source of wealth, since without poverty there could be no labor, and there could be no riches, no refinement, no comfort, and no benefit to those who may be possessed of wealth. I want to give credit to Chris, who sent me the email that triggered all this with this link. He said, "Somehow I didn't know that the British industrial working class had to be conjured into existence by forcing the self-sufficient peasantry away from the resources that made them self-sufficient. In that light, Jefferson's vision of a nation of independent smallholders was doomed from the start. Even people who weren't loyalists would still have wanted to imitate the British political economic system, such as Hamilton. The more I learn about how the system is built to oppose and discourage what you're doing, the more I admire what you do." Again, I know some of that may be hard to hear, but most of what you didn't want to hear was the words of people that you've been taught were pro-liberty. Their own words. Not what somebody said they meant, but what they said. Like, they wrote it down so we can, like, look at it and read it and stuff. Again, I had to think a lot about what to call today's show. And what this led me to was the distinction between a system of capitalism, in general statism in the form of modern fascism in most nations that would be called capitalists today, and natural capitalism. To me, natural capitalism is the only truly natural system of economics we have. Natural capitalism recognizes that people acquire things, and if they do so by legitimate means, it's their property. Further, that some people are better at or like to do some things more than other people do. Hence, trade is a way for people to gain that which they do not have. And in doing so, both parties are better off for it. Further, natural capitalism recognizes that most people don't want to hurt or kill others. Even more so that people do not want to be hurt or killed. So it is simply better for everyone to conduct trade between individuals, tribes, nations, rather than take by force what one wants. Even when you're the type that will steal, harm, and kill, the reality is if you do it long enough, someone's likely to do it back to you. When most people use the term capitalism in a positive way, this is what they mean. For instance, if I grow food and I sell the surplus to Tom, Tom's money is now mine to keep or spend or do whatever I want with. My food is now Tom's. He can eat it. He can share it. He can sell it to someone else for a profit. He can do whatever he wants to it. He can throw it away. He acquired it with his rightfully acquired capital. I now have the capital. He now has a form of natural capital in the form of food. It's up to us to decide whether we want to trade or not. It's our choice. If Tom doesn't want to buy from me, he doesn't have to. If I don't want to sell to Tom, I don't have to. And that's all good and well, but what happens when the state gets involved and something natural is made forced, unnatural or coerced? As we have seen so far with this article, and we will see more of today, many times some very bad things happen. What we can say the same thing about, though, is the supposed antonym of capitalism, socialism. We think of socialism as a form of economics, but it really isn't until the state forces it to be such. Socialism is a natural state. It's the cooperation by humans because those cooperating view it as beneficial to them to do so. If 20 people settle around a lake, for instance, and see it as vital to their lives, then they'll set up some agreements. It's socialism. It's also natural socialism, not economic socialism run by the state. The agreements in the lake situation might be on, well, how many fish can we take out of the lake? Perhaps there's even a way where fish are shared, if we all agree to that. How much water can be used for irrigation? What can and can't be put in the lake? If it needs maintenance, you know, then the people may pool labor to do the work, or they may pool money, and everybody throws some money in, and we get the work done by somebody with a machine. This is pure, honest socialism. The choice is up to the individual. If you want to be part of this group, these are the rules the group has agreed to. And if you don't want to be part of this group, you are free to go anywhere you want. No one will compel you to come here and be part of what we're doing. Systemic socialism is when the person is required to be part of the group they never asked to be part of, and their property is taken in the name of the collective good. What I'm trying to say today is capitalism and socialism can both be wonderful things when humans are left to their natural inclinations and using them on a voluntary basis. But once the state gets involved, either can be used to enslave a population. And I know as I was reading that, and you were thinking about these poor people working in these death trap factories and barely making enough money to live and, you know, yet almost living in the damn things, basically being in a forced work camp type situation. When I was talking about it, you think, well, that's not how America works. Well, that's because we outsourced it. It was at one time a lot how America worked really heavily pre-Civil War years in America. The antebellum was very much that way for a lot of people. We had something that other nations didn't have, though. But we were very much mimicking the way our father, our nation's father, Great Britain, was, right? I mean, it's how the people have really, really looked at America at the time was that, yeah, we had this war with Great Britain, and yeah, we were our own independent thing, but Great Britain was still the father. In fact, I believe one of the founders said during the negotiations for the Declaration of Independence, may the sword of the father never spill the blood of the son. So this was a mindset. So today, the conditions described are very much like the conditions in China. And I know what you'll say, but China's communist. China's at least socialist. Right? Yeah. It doesn't matter what they are, though. We use them for that source of labor in their poverty. And there is a belief that the only way to get people to do anything is for them to have to eat, or they'll just sit around and do nothing. And some people will. But that's not society as a whole. That's not how people work. I honestly, at this point in my life, if I didn't want more than I have, if I didn't want to continue to teach, if I didn't want to continue to inspire, I have enough that right now I could sit back and I wouldn't be able to do all the things that I do financially anymore, but I could live a decent life better than most peasant farmers for the rest of my life until I die. I am driven to do more. The issue is that the elite become convinced that they are the only people like that. That's these people that you were hearing about. And we have modern versions of them today. The lower class must be controlled or they are a threat to your way of life. That's how these people think. Now, I'm not talking about all rich people. I don't mean that. There are a lot of really good rich people, but there are also a lot of elitist scum. And it's not about, I'm going to use these words now as forms of economic control by the state. I'm going to come out of the natural forms of them. Socialist, capitalist, fascist, communist. It doesn't matter what the system is. The people in the elite class, and there's always an elite class. There was an elite class in the Soviet Union. There is an elite class in China. There's an elite class in places like Iran. It does, and that's a theocracy, right? It doesn't matter what the system of control is. The elite class, if they have access to the apparatus that is the state, and they always will, by the nature of being the elite class, will use that system to control others. We can use capitalism to control a society, and we can use socialism to control a society. I know what you're conditioned to say, but capitalism gives the individual more opportunity to change their lot in life. I agree. It doesn't mean that capitalism can't be used to control a society, and it is. And in general, as soon as the state gets involved, I don't care what you say, that you know the U.S. is a capitalist economy. The U.S. is a socialist economy, and the type of socialism that we most resemble is fascism, and specifically what I call neo-fascism. And what a lot of people don't realize when they say things like neocon or neoliberal or whatever, what neo means. Neo means new. People throw that word around all the time. No idea what it means. No idea when they say neocon, they're saying new conservatives. Well, neo-fascism is the revised version of fascism that the United States has been aggressively pursuing since just before World War II, but specifically after World War II. In a classic fascist economy, the state and industry work together and they leverage the differences between the classes, lower class, upper class, middle class, etc., to the advantage of both industry and the state. But in old fascism, classic fascism, the state was in control. In neo-fascism, the industry is in control. Instead of the state harnessing industry to do the state's bidding, industry buys through lobbying the influence of the state so that the state does the business of industry. That's why, and if you doubt that, then you have to explain how almost every piece of legislation that's been passed in the last 40 years has been written by corporations, not by congressmen and senators. I'm serious. If you go and take any law that was written and you trace it back to its origin, you see Congressman Ass Clown 3 is the one that introduced it. If you keep going from there, you'll find he didn't write it and his staff didn't write it. A corporation wrote it, gave it to a lobbyist, who put it on his desk along with a big fat campaign contribution. Then, yes, the Congress clowns will wrangle it out, and they will make alterations. But most of the alterations are Congressman Ass Clown 4 also got visited by a lobbyist, and he wanted his little thing added onto it. And so we literally have had our laws driven by the whims of industry for decades. And not because capitalism is bad, because the systems of control will always be utilized by the elite class. That it doesn't matter if it was socialism. Then they would do it with socialism instead of, you know, sort of like a hybrid between fascism and capitalism. The problem for socialists is the economics actually break down much quicker. Because things do start to fall apart. Because there is an inkling of truth to the elitist capitalist belief that if we don't make the poor miserable, they won't work. Well, there's a big difference in the poor being left to their small holding and to hunt venison and to grow their own food and to conduct commerce amongst each other and form voluntary associations where they share resources and common ownership of certain things. And here is free money and free stuff. There's a huge difference. If you leave people to themselves, there are people that will be industrious in engineering and want to do other things, and there will be people that will be happy with that, but they will have to do something. They will all drive some sort of, you know, progress. But when we try to make that's natural socialism and natural capitalism coexisting as a single thing, because there is no such thing as a society without socialism as an adjective. It doesn't exist. It doesn't exist. Put 20 people together. They start making plans. They start figuring out. I get emails all the time. We had one yesterday. How do I create a mutual aid group? You mean socialism? No, socialism is Venezuela. No, that socialism is an economic system of control. We're talking about social interaction, right? As a natural way that humans interact. You put people together and they form alliances. They form cooperatives. They form ways by which they can help each other and mutually benefit because it's what we do. They also commence to trading. You want this? Well, I don't feel like doing that today, but you know what? If you gave me some of that, I could trouble myself to do it. This is the way humans naturally are. And if you go to any indigenous society where the socialist utopianists will say, see, this is how they live. They share everything. No, they don't. No, they don't. They share a lot of things. They also have freedom to leave. No one makes anybody stay. And there will be trade and commerce. Many times you'll see is that group does, certain indigenous groups today still, if they're left alone enough, they pretty much do share everything amongst themselves. But then they have some sort of external economy, some sort of thing they produce that brings in an income that requires trade with outside entities. And you don't get to just go be part of that, and they don't go out and grab people and make them be part of it. So they have capitalism as an economic natural system, and socialism is a natural social way that people interact, coexisting in complete peace until we go screw it up. Because what always screws it up is the state. So you only have two approaches to making these things work without people being heavily controlled. One is an anarchist system, and the other is a minarchist system. For those that can't quite get their head around how we could live in a 100% voluntary society, if you have a small enough form of government, these things can mostly work themselves out. They really can. However, and this is the great problem, the state is an organism. We don't think of it as an organism, we think of it as an agreement, a contract between people and their masters. But the state literally is an organism. And it's an organism that we describe at times as continuity of government. Of course, continuity of government being a plan, if we get nuked or something, how do we, you know, go forward? But continuity of government exists even without a plan for it. And what I mean by that is when you look at, let's say this is the United States, which is a fairly young country, but still well over 200 years old now. All of the people that put it together are dead. It's still here. All of the people that were the kids 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 of the people that put it together are dead. Okay? They're all dead. And yet it's still here. And it got bigger all by itself. Well, no, the congressman did it. No. It existed. And because it existed, the people that will use any system that exists to control others did so. And by its very nature, it grew. So the problem with minarchism isn't that it works or doesn't work. It's that it works so well that it ends up creating the most colossal state known to man. in our case, the United States of America. You really can't think of a more colossal empire, a bigger state, with more ways of controlling people, not just within its borders, but around the world, than the United States of America. We're talking about a country, we have a military presence in well over 100 nations. We tell other nations what they can and can't do, and a lot of times they actually listen to us. We can change the price of tea in China. We can actually do that. Seriously. We have that much power and that much control. Well, how did we get it? Because the state is an organism. It literally grows by the very fact that it exists in the first place. So when you create a minarchist society, very few rules. Roads, we'll build roads, yeah? We'll do that with stolen money because we can't figure out how else to do it. All right. And, you know, we'll, bridges, we'll do that too. And maybe we'll even have some sort of a basic form of education for people. And then if somebody steals some shit, there'll be some guys that go take it back and put that guy in a cage until he learns his lesson. Somebody kills somebody, we'll throw a rope over a tree and have a formal way in which we decide to stretch his neck to keep, you know, things from getting out of hand with lynch mobs. But that's kind of it, you know. You don't get to take somebody else's property, they don't get to take yours, you don't get to hurt people, and instead of having some sort of, you know, basic tribalistic way that that's handled, like, don't go mess with those people because they'll kill you back, right? We have this kind of minarchist society. What will happen is whatever power that entity, that state is given, it will use that limited power to create another power. And now we'll have more power. And it will use that limited power to create another power. And then it will have more power. And it will continue to grow. And that is exactly how this country became what it is. From a standpoint of interfering in the lives of people. Our nation is at the same time one of the greatest forces for good that has ever existed. And at the exact same time, one of the greatest forces for evil. And if you don't believe that, all you got to do is look at the body count and the bomb count. I know you may not like hearing that, but the numbers don't lie. Our nation has been bombing or shooting somebody for the vast majority of its existence. I don't remember the exact number of years now, but it is almost ridiculous. It is almost ridiculous. There are people alive today that are young adults who have never lived while the United States wasn't at war with somebody. And yet, we are, at this point in history, probably the single best hope, if you want freedom and liberty, is to live here. And the way we got into that conflict is this organism component to the state. It will grow, and it will grow without real restriction. You think you're restricting it, but all it has to do is trick the current generation into removing a restriction for their own good. And if you don't think this place can turn into Venezuela, you're wrong. It can. And if you don't think this place can turn into a much better place than it is today, you're also wrong. It's up to us. In the end, we decide how much we let the people that are in charge control us. The problem in America today is at the same time the state has bloated itself into the most controlling it's ever been, we have people that want to be controlled. The system of indoctrination we call education has been so effective that we have people like the young man mentioned yesterday in yesterday's closing that when asked, well, you know, if you're going to join the military and go off to these countries, like, what do you know about these wars and why we're there and should we be there? And basically his answer is, people smarter than me can worry about that. You're getting ready at 18 to sign away a huge portion of your freedom to state you will do what you are asked to do within certain boundaries for a number of years, 4, 6, whatever it is. And if you don't, you're giving the other party the right to put you in prison. You that's what happens. If you go in the military and you're sent somewhere and you say, I'm not going, and you go AWOL, they will arrest you and put you in Fort Leavenworth, if you're in the Army anyway. You're agreeing to that. You're agreeing to take orders from somebody you don't even know yet. And you just figure that people that are smarter than you got it figured out? And it doesn't even give you pause? You see, that's where we're at in society, and that's why we're in such a precarious position today. What's kept us free is that actual capitalism is a natural human behavior. And because of that, and because of the amount of liberty that does exist, even with all the flaws we have, there have been so many examples of what people can achieve that we've maintained enough people in our population that believe in that possibility and try to acquire it for themselves. You know, this leads me to a question that I hear the left ask a lot. And I've never heard anybody but me answer it the way I'm about to answer it for you. The question is, why does rural America, the middle class and lower class Americans, throughout all these rural areas that always vote Republican, why do they vote against policies that would be in their own self-interest? I mean, if you think about it, taxing the shit out of the rich and giving the money to the poor seems like it's in the best interest of the poor. And some guy making 25 grand a year changing oil in you know, podunk West Virginia qualifies. And that's what they're asking. So, like, basically, we're saying we want all this good stuff taken from the rich and given to people just like you. Why would you vote against that? I don't even understand why it's a question, because the answer is just painfully obvious. Morality. See, that guy making 25 grand a year changing oil part-time at a Quickie Lube, you know, in podunk West Virginia, he actually feels this way. That guy over there that has what he has, I don't have any right to it. Just because I have less doesn't mean I have a right to it. That morality is what's kept this nation from completely falling into the grip of socialism as an economic system for over 200 years. It's that morality. As that morality erodes and people take the true history of capitalism that we talked about today as a system of control, we have gotten into a place in society where people naturally want to bifurcate into one of two sides. They want to fractionalize into A or B, Coke or Pepsi, gold or silver, right? A false dichotomy. And if you can convince them that capitalism, without even really defining what you mean by that, is bad, then they believe what? Their only alternative is socialism. Capitalism isn't working. Capitalism has worked since the dawn of human beings. Again, it is a natural form of economics. We're using the same word and we mean different things. The first time a band, a tribe of nomadic people was walking across plains, and they looked across the plains, and there was another group of people coming the other direction. And they were like, man, I don't know, these guys could be dangerous. And the other side was like, oh, these guys could be dangerous. So they kind of carefully approached each other and figured out some means of communication, so they probably used somewhat of a different language or at least dialect, and realized, okay, we don't want to hurt you, you don't want to hurt us, we're going to go on our way, but hey, wait a minute. You guys got a lot of meat there. Well, yes, we are a tribe of hunters. We have much meat. Well, we don't really have a lot of meat. We got a whole bunch of this wild grain of some sort that we foraged. Could we trade you some of this grain for some of your meat? And they said, yes, you could do that. And that exchange happened. And specifically, once that exchange happened and these two groups of people realized that one was settled here and one was settled there and one had different resources than the other, and they could have ongoing trade amongst each other, natural capitalism was born. And it has been the bedrock of human interrelationship since such a thing existed. But again, there are people, and we call them psychopaths, that wish to control other people. I believe they are literally mentally defective. And these people will come into that, and later, with the advent of agriculture, figure out how to create stores of value and write a slip for grain in a building against it and use that as a mechanism of control. Or at the advent of the Industrial Revolution, realize, hey, we got to get all these lazy-ass peasants off their ass and in here working. You know, look at them. They're sitting over there. They got their geese and their cows and their pigs. They work 4 or 5 hours a day. They hang out with each other and get drunk on apple cider from apples they just pick up off the ground that fall every year. We got to figure out how to get them in here. We'll call it capitalism. In short, when you and I say capitalism, we mean free enterprise. We mean people voluntarily doing business with each other. When the people that are critical of capitalism use the word capitalism, they're talking about control of the capital itself. They're talking about the banks. And not your little podunk bank that you go down to and you know the name of the loan officer on a first-name basis. The big banks that actually print the money, that leverage your debt to write blank checks for themselves. You're both right. But the solution is wrong on both sides. The solution is letting these people do whatever they want in the name of a free market, or the solution is complete control of the population in the name of equity and equality. Neither one of those will work because it's forced coercion. I know it's a kind of a double affirmative, I guess, or something there. For you really can't have coercion that isn't forced, can you? But it actually bears being said because it's so valid. We are forcing people to do things they don't want to do against their will, who otherwise would be harming no one, because we want things to be our way. The greatest misery that was necessary for this way of life to exist has been largely outsourced to the third world. Now, what do I want to do about that? Not a lot. That's those people's issue to sort out. China's issues, I don't want to interfere with China. I don't want to interfere with Venezuela. I don't want to interfere with Korea. I don't want to interfere with anybody. I want everybody to live their life their own way. And I want nations to trade with each other. In the words of Jefferson, I would like commerce with all and alliances with none. Probably our greatest founder, the most proactive advocate of liberty that came out of that group of founders was Jefferson. Those are his words. There's something else we need to accept about many of our founders, though. Our founders were not a bunch of, you know, pure libertarians that didn't believe in a class system. They largely did. They were largely trying to create a new style of aristocracy for themselves. Including, I mean, Washington and Adams, definitely, for all the good they did, that was their legitimate goal. We must create this aristocracy that the people that just fought to get rid of one will accept. And the people were largely willing to do it because many of them were proud Englishmen, even now as Americans. They liked this idea. They had been taught. They had been indoctrinated too. Breaking the cycle? Jefferson had the idea for breaking the cycle. I believe it was the real reason for the idea, and that was the small holdings. That each of us should develop our own small holding, our own place to provide some of what we need for ourselves. This is the way to liberty, and it's why society is so hell-bent against it. Society is against it. That's why people that go out and live off the land are considered weird and freaks and hippies. But yet, we just constantly have generation after generation, huge segments that want to do it. Why? Because it's innately human. We were meant to put our hands in soil and our feet bare upon the ground. We were meant to do that. We are not an agricultural species. Agricultural, making us an agricultural species, which is the culture of land. Agriculture means not the culture of plants, it means the culture of land. Making us an agricultural species was the primary means by which society was placed under the control of the ruling class. And the primary way you do that is you take people out of what you would call a horticultural existence. These peasant farmers were not agricultural people. They were horticultural people. By the very lack of mechanization, they kind of had to be. You couldn't put in a farm of 8,000 acres. It wasn't doable. You couldn't manage it. You had to have a small holding. And then you had to provide quite a bit of your own food. So you can't eat bread alone. So you might grow some wheat or some barley or some form of grain on a nice flat place to do that. But all the fields were lined with trees. And anything that was a natural resource, to some degree, was protected. So in the fields of these peasants, there were also these apple trees that came from Kazakhstan. But as soon as they figured out how to put the seed in the ground, this apple thing comes off of it. Everybody planted them. Hazelnuts grew. Some oaks produced acorns that were valuable food either for people or for livestock. So then other livestock were added. Everybody had a kitchen garden and an herb garden and grew things. Everybody had a pig, and all the waste went to the pig. This is how these people were living. And this was a threat to what these new capitalists, neo-capitalists of the time, I guess, wanted. They wanted giant factories. They wanted mechanization. We live in a society today where a lot of that work can be done with equipment. You could afford to pay one guy a living wage who works in your factory because with mechanization, he's doing the work that used to be done by 10 or 15 or 20 people. When you need 10 or 15 or 20 people to do it, then you have to pay them a slave wage. They have to work 12 hours a day, 7 days a week or more. How did we get to the point where we had, you know, a 40-hour work week and some time off and stuff like that? You know, people want to say, well, the unions and government did it. No, the unions and government did it. It was a natural way for humans to move. You could only get so much out of people treating them like that for so long. If you want to grow and compete in the true sense of capitalism, Henry Ford did more for the 40-hour week than unions did. And that's a fact. Henry Ford was a capitalist. He was also an elitist. But see, the thing about capitalism, again, is the only natural form of economics. The more of it you allow to be unleashed by a society, the more freedom people have to choose how they want to live. Because that's what real liberty is. Real liberty isn't, you know, just, you know, where you live or what name you call yourself. It's the ability to choose the life that you want. Some people want to live in the yuppie area of Manhattan or Long Island or wherever, and they want to live in an urban shithole as far as I'm concerned, but they want to be able to walk out their door and have all of this stuff available to them for money. Some people want to live in the middle of woods, in the middle of nowhere. Some people want to live kind of in the urban rural fringe where I live, where, you know, I'm kind of out in the country and do whatever I want, but I can be downtown in 20 minutes if there's no traffic. There's all different options in this country, and what has created that is, in spite of the controlling mechanisms of capitalism, the liberating aspects of capitalism is what has made this nation so great and created so much opportunity for so many. There are very few places in the world where a kid from the coal region of Pennsylvania can build a community like the Survival Podcast and live the life that he wants to live, and no one can come take it away from him. For now. Because the thing about liberty is it's not inherited. Each generation must struggle to retain the liberty the prior generation left behind for them. They must fight to keep it. There will always be forces seeking to take it. That's just the way that it is. And I hope this helps you just have a new mindset. When you hear terms like socialist and capitalist, libertarian, communist, we have created a new vocabulary for the control of the minds of the people. We have redefined what things mean. Ask someone with a negative view of capitalism, what is capitalism? And if you can get them to stop spouting the collegiate propaganda for long enough about rich fat cats and whatever and parasites and whatever. You say, no, I want you to actually, what is it? Define the system. Don't use adjectives that are purgative. Define what it means. What makes a society capitalist? What does it mean? You'll find when they finally get down to the root definition, what they'll say is that the institutions, the corporate institutions of the society control the capital itself, they control the money, and that makes it capitalism. To me, that's an oligarchy. It's not capitalism. And we can agree with people that we vehemently disagree with politically that, yeah, that's a problem. The fact that the banks print the money based on a promise that you will pay it back, that's a problem. That's not good. That is an incredibly controlling situation. But you notice the socialists that advocate for political socialism never address that. Tax the rich guy. Tax the rich guy. It's never, hey, you know what? Maybe we should take away the ability for these people to print money on the backs of promises on people's behalf through both taxation and through fractional reserve lending. Like, no one ever points that out. Why? Because it's very good for the people in power, for the people they have control over, to bifurcate into two camps and fight with each other over the thing that isn't the actual problem. That's why. So the solution, it's up to you, man. How are you going to live your life? Are you going to sit around and wail and gnash your teeth? This is the problem with the left. The left finds out all these terrible things that happened in the name of capitalism, and, we got to fix it by taking it away from them. And the right finds all these horrible things that happened in the name of socialism, and, we got to fight them. I mean, all you do is fight each other. And the people that are in control, they're not letting go anytime soon. So what's the solution? The solution is you take control of your life and the things that you can put your hands on and the things that you can touch, the things that you can actually control and influence. If you want a small holding, you build your small holding. If you want a big company, you build your big company. You do it in spite of the mechanisms of control. That's what they're actually afraid of. That's why they're afraid of, equally afraid of, the billionaire entrepreneur who doesn't give a damn what the state does and plays outside the state systems. That wants to set up freaking seasteading or something like that. And they're equally afraid of the redneck hippie duck farmer who sends a message that if you don't want to live within their systems of control, you don't have to. They're afraid of everybody that thinks that way. Now, they're not afraid of the individual. What they're afraid of is that if you leave people alone long enough, that mindset will reach what's called a critical mass. A critical mass is when it's not a majority, it's a sufficient number that it can no longer be stopped. It continues to grow organically and naturally on its own, so it not just becomes a majority, but it becomes a supermajority. And if you can get any group of a significant group of people to think a certain way, especially if that certain way or that certain thing is valid and actually works, it's almost like there's like one more. We don't know what the number is, but you can be one under it and it doesn't happen. And once you go one over and you hit that critical mass, it's unstoppable. It starts to roll and you no longer can control it, so you have to come up with a new system of control. That's what they're afraid of. That's why they're so big on every child should go to college, because that puts everybody in debt. Well, that's great. Now we have another means to control them. You know, Hamilton wanted to control the states from the seat of the federal government by making sure the states were in debt. And today, the oligarchy wants to control society in the name of education, but education that thereby requires that they become in debt. Well, you know, Bernie Sanders wants college to be free. College is not going to be free. And in the countries you think college is free, it's not free. Somebody pays for it. That's just another way to economically control people. And guess what? Everybody doesn't get to go. You can literally be an idiot that barely gets through high school with a D average, and you can still, if you really want to, get in and go to a college in this country and get someone to pay for it with a loan. If you are that person in these countries where college is supposedly free, you don't get to go to any college. They don't just say, well, anybody who wants to go can come. By the time you're getting close to graduating high school, they've classified you. You're college bound. You're high value college bound, right? And not the competitive thing we have here where you got to try to sell yourself to Harvard. They just say, like, you're Harvard quality. You know, Oxford over there, I guess, right? But then it's like your trade level. You're not going. You don't get to. They decide for you who and what you'll be. It's just another way to control people. Here, we have a lot more freedom. So you got to find a way to do it that doesn't get in the way of the perception of freedom. So, hey, just take a loan. All of a sudden, these colleges are like, you know what? Sure, we'll let you in. Yeah, we don't give a shit. We're out of space. Build another building. How are we going to do that? Oh, some dumbass gives these kids loans. Well, how much? As much as whatever we charge. When I recharge, I'll just give them money. You're like, well, how can the oligarchy make money? Because it's not real. It's fake money. Your promise to pay it back lets them write a check against nothing except you. Now you owe them. They just created money out of thin air that you're going to spend that goes into the economy that they run. Or you break the cycle. Does that mean you don't go to college? No. It means you don't go to college unless you know why you're going. Unless you sit down and go, this education leads to this career path. This is how much money I'm going to have to spend to get there. This is my time to pay it back. And Excel doesn't lie, and it says that if I do this, that this will pay off for me. How many people that go and take out $80,000 or more in loans do you think do that? Do you think it makes sense to borrow $80,000 with no idea how much money you're going to make just because somebody said you'll make more with a degree than without one? Doesn't make any sense at all. Another means of control. But you decide. You decide to get the degree in gender studies or to get the degree in engineering or to walk your own path on independent study. You decide. You decide where to live and how to live. You decide what you're going to do and what you're not going to do with your life. And if I've said anything in the last 11 years about how to take control for yourself, it's that. That message for me will never change. With that, we've wrapped up another episode of the Survival Podcast, and want to remind you one of the ways you can help support us is do your online shopping at tspaz.com. That's T-S-P-A-Z.com. When you go to tspaz.com, no matter what you eventually buy, you will help out the Survival Podcast and the work that we do. I've got a product of the day for you. It's a new one. I've been doing a lot of reusing the last couple of weeks. I've been so busy. I got a bunch of new stuff coming out that I've been testing and using here, and this one is kind of a redo, but it's a new brand, a new type. So I'm a big advocate for making coffee and tea and doing some other things like marinades and what have you in your kitchen of using a French press. I think a French press makes the best coffee that you can make in your house. I think there are some machines that are commercially available that cost thousands and thousands of dollars that can do better, but what the average person could do in their house without spending, you know, hundreds or thousands of dollars, a French press for $25-$30 is the best you can do. I have recommended one by a company called Fine Dine for quite a while. It is an awesome press, but the body is made of glass. And I think it's great because you can see what's inside there and it looks cool. But my wife and I have been talking about getting a second French press because I drink a lot less coffee than I used to. I drink a cup or two in the morning, and I switch over to tea. Sometimes she wants more coffee. Sometimes there's still another cup of coffee in there. She's not ready to pour it out yet, and I want to make it. You see what I mean? So I don't really mind cleaning it out and switching to tea, but sometimes it's just not available. So I'm like, I should get another one. She's like, you know what? We should take our French press when we go on vacation. That way we can make coffee instead of the shitty coffee that they have, the shitty coffee makers they have in the hotel rooms. And yes, that is a quote from my wife, and God, I love that woman. So I was thinking, well, if we're going to get a second one and we're going to take it on vacation, and the way baggage handlers are, we should get one that's not made out of glass, so it's less likely to get broken. Well, I found this one made by a company called Sakura, and it's made out of stainless steel and it's insulated. It's an excellent French press. It's about $25 for 34 ounces, which is kind of a standard size. They also have a big one that's 50 ounces for $34. Both of them are linked in the article. You should check it out. It really is a great product. I'm really impressed with it. It's got over 4,000 reviews, a 4.5-star overall rating, and I checked on FakeSpot. They got a B. So it ain't an A, but you know the majority of those reviews are legitimate reviews by people that bought this thing and use this thing. I've bought it. I'm using it. If I can come up with a single criticism, the top, right, that goes down on top of it when you're pushing the plunger down, that covers it, it doesn't fit real tight. You can kind of jiggle it around a little bit, so it doesn't seal like a thermos or something like that. So some people were bitching on some of the negative reviews that it doesn't keep your coffee hot for like a long time. I don't know what a long time is, but when you put coffee or tea in a French press, when you push it down, you do get a pretty decent separation of the liquid and the solid, but there is still some exchange, and it gets tannic and not so good after a while anyway. If you wanted to make, you know, a bunch of coffee and store it long term, put it in a thermos or a dispenser of some sort, you know, you don't keep it for hours in a French press anyway. It does stay hot for a long time. I made some Earl Grey yesterday and tried it out, and about 30 minutes into it, I poured the last cup, and it was still steaming hot. I don't know what else you want. I'll tell you what I think these special children that went to the government indoctrination centers might have a problem with. The lid has a way that you turn it where you can pour the coffee or tea or whatever out of it. And there's a little arrow there because unlike the glass one, you can't see in the side. And that's where it's got a big old gap. Well, when you turn it about 25% of the way, it closes that gap. I think some of these special little children don't understand to close the damn thing. You can imagine why. Anyway, I think it's the great French press. I've heard from a couple of people that already bought it that say they like it. So check it out. Remember, when you're thinking about coffee, we have three great coffee producers in the MSB. They are Holler Roast, Food Forest Farms, and Mai Tai Coffee. They all give you discounts. So if you're going to get your French press, that's what should go in it. And the write-up today, I give away two of my favorite hand-blended teas that you can make yourself. And as always, if you shop at Tea Spaz, you help support the Survival Podcast and the work that we do. Let's talk about our song of the day today. It is Hey Cinderella by Susie Boggess. And, of course, we're doing all songs this week that were inspired by fairy tales. And I want to speak to, because I think that, you know, if you didn't put your ideology on the shelf like I asked you to today, you might be thinking Jack is advocating socialism as in the way people usually think about it. I don't know where you'd come off of that, but I know I'm going to get an email or two. That type of socialism, you might as well call it a Cinderella story. It sounds good, but it doesn't happen. It doesn't work. Our society is so content today that we have the luxury of bitching about having to do anything for anything and saying that someone should provide it to us as a right because our society works that good. And it literally is a fairy tale that you can have a place where everybody's just given not just what they need, but everything that they want and have at work. And that's kind of what this song's about. But this song's about the propensity that I have to say, I know I'm going to get hate mail over this, but I think that women fall into this more than men, not that men don't ever at all. But this concept of the Disney style of life that ends with, and they lived happily ever after. And so many young people get married today with this viewpoint that marriage will just be this fairy tale. In fact, we make our weddings as fairy tale like as possible. The bride is in a beautiful dress and there's pomp and circumstance and everybody has a big party and everybody wishes them a happy future. And then they find out marriage is work. Or in the words of my wife, love is a choice. And love as a choice requires work. And instead of teaching people this, we continue to perpetrate the fairy tale belief, and then we wonder why we have such a high divorce rate. People should go to marriage a lot like they go to college when that's the right choice for them. They should make a decision that they really want to be with this person for the rest of their life, but also that they're willing to do the hard work that will eventually come. Otherwise, you may find yourself saying to yourself, hey, Cinderella, what happened? With that, it's been Jack Spirico with another edition of the Survival Podcast, helping you figure out how to live that better life if times get tough or even if they don't.
We believed in fairy tales that day. I watched your father give you away. Your aim was true. Pink bouquet fell right into my hands. We danced for hours and we drank champagne. You screamed and laughed when I got up and sang. And then you rode away in a white Mustang to your castle in the sand. Through the years and the kids and the jobs and the dreams that lost their way. Do you ever see? now, 'cause we have to be on the turn.